Michael Korda, the best-selling author of Hero and Alone, tells the story of the First World War not in any conventional way, but through the intertwined lives of the soldier poets who came to describe it best, and indeed to symbolize the war's tragic arc and lethal fury. Korda's account, which includes anecdotes from his own family history, not only brings to life the soldier poets, but paints an unforgettable picture of life and death in the trenches and the sacrifice of an entire generation. The name of the new book is Muse of Fire, World War I as seen through the lives of the soldier poets, and it's a great pleasure to welcome our dear friend Michael Korda back to the roundtable. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
I am well, thank you, Joe. I'm happy that you're well. I'm back at work again.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. What brought you to this idea of writing about the soldier poets and looking at them and looking at this overall topic in such detail?
Well, I think that I've always been interested in the First World War. And as I point out in Muse of Fire, I was born 15 years after the First World War ended. And my grandfather, my English grandfather, Octavius Musgrove, fought in the British Army. My father and his brother both fought in the Austro-Hungarian Army on the other side. So the First World War has always seemed very near to me, even though I lived through the Second World War. The First World War had a kind of shadowy impact over my life. And I wanted to write about it at some point, but didn't think that another history of the First World War was needed until it occurred to me that the poets who were significant in the war, if you took them one at a time chronologically, would take you through each period of the war, from Rupert Brooke at its very beginning and before it, to Wilfred Owen, who was killed just 5 days before the armistice was signed. So it was really a different way of writing about the First World War.
The biography, which is really a group biography, the title, of course, comes from Shakespeare and Henry V. Why is that Muse of Fire such a good way of clarifying and classifying these soldier poets?
Well, I think because when we talk of poetry, we talk of the muse, searching the muse. But in the case of the First World War poets, there is, in fact, a muse of fire. All of them served in the trenches, many of them. Most of them were wounded. Some of them were notable heroes. And some of them, of course, were killed in battle. So they were not poets writing from a distance about things. They were poets who actually were writing in the trenches. I was very moved when my wife Maggie and myself visited the Jewish Museum in New York on Fifth Avenue. They had a show of the Sassoon family, and one of the things on display was Siegfried Sassoon's pocket notebooks, in which he wrote poetry in tiny letters while in the trenches. And it's just impossible to imagine how somebody could sit in a trench, not just muddy and rainy and wet, but being shelled and shot at, and write poetry. So they are, in fact, serving a muse of fire. They all are soldier poets, not just poets.
You write that when more than other wars, that World War I really came to be encapsulated by the poetry it produced, much like you just described. And one of the things that you make clear in the book is that is helped by the fact that it really escaped official censorship. Talk a little bit about that and why. I mean, I guess the importance is obvious, but of what it gives us a window into now.
Well, I think the First World War was the most tightly censored of wars. It was in the age before easy photography. I mean, cameras were big and bulky. and very few people were going to get out of the trenches and hold the equivalent of a big Graflex and take a picture, let alone a big movie camera on a tripod. So the photos that came out of the war, for the most part, were faked, not real, and did not show what was actually going on. Dispatches from the front to newspapers and magazines were very tightly censored and written with a huge degree of enthusiasm that was inappropriate for most of the time. The poets got away with their poetry because nobody thought that poetry was all that important. And that's why they could write as they did with such complete frankness about what the war was like and what was going on. It's not so improbable, you know, for poetry to be the descriptive factor in a war. All that we know about the Trojan War comes from the Iliad and the Odyssey. So it's an old tradition.
Michael Korda joins us this morning. Again, the name of the new book is Muse of Fire. There are many people that you write about in the book, and I'm just going to pick out a few that I'd like to touch on. One is Edward Marsh, who was Winston Churchill's private secretary. But give us a sense of why Edward Marsh is such an important figure when it comes to the of the poets, of the poetry, and getting that work out into the world.
Well, Marsh, apart from being Winston Churchill's private secretary, who copy edited it and corrected several million of the great man's works, which is a lifetime job in itself, was a discriminating and very focused judge of poetry. And his enthusiasm for poetry was vitally important. He communicated it to others. He got them published. In Isaac Rosenberg's case, he not only managed Rosenberg's career as a poet, but Rosenberg's reputation as a painter. So Marsh was a huge factor. He had unerring taste. He edited much of this poetry, and he made sure that people read it and saw it and got it published if he could. He's a major force in English literature.
And take, for example, Siegfried Sassoon, who you mentioned earlier in our conversation, but he was the editor of that, and like others, would take the work, and even if they were friends, like somebody like Rupert Brooks, of what they were saying and putting that into an important literary context.
Yes, he did. And also, he published the Georgian poets, several volumes of collections, which were enormously influential and very widely read. One of the points I make in Muse of Fire is that the First World War occurred during an age when poetry still mattered to people at every level of education and at every level of society. I mean, poets were read intensely, and Rudyard Kipling sold in the quantities of best-selling novelists today, and Rupert Brooke was as famous and as admired as a rock star today. So poetry was important during the period of the First World War, and was also written about things that were actually happening, unlike the modernist poetry that would follow, written, say, by T.S. Eliot, which is inward-looking. These poets were still writing narrative poetry about things which they saw and things which happened, and in a way which connected them deeply to other people.
You read about Brooke, you read about Sassoon and Owen, Alan Seeger, Robert Graves. These are fascinating characters. You also, there's two things I want to ask you about Alan Seeger. Alan Seeger is fascinating because, first of all, he was American, which is really interesting, a Harvard graduate. Also, we should note the uncle of Pete Seeger, which that's
yes, you are.
That's fascinating. Probably best known for the line, "I have a rendezvous with death." How does this American figure into this very British group?
Well, I felt obliged to squeeze it in. First of all, because I was a little short of poets who actually served in the ranks. Most of the English poets that I write about were junior officers. And although they lived a terrible life, they still lived a considerably better life than ordinary soldiers did. So I needed a couple of ordinary soldiers. I found one in Isaac Rosenberg, which was convenient because he's also one of the most significant poets and painters to come out of and to die in the First World War. And then I got attracted by Seeger, about whom I did not know much, in part because when he attended Harvard, his roommates were T.S. Eliot, and I just thought, that's so fascinating. I mean, it's just hard to imagine how you would end up with T.S. Eliot as your roommate at Harvard and what an effect that would have on him. So I began to look at Seeger in a very intense way and found him one of the most interesting of the poets.
I want to go back to Sassoon because this is a poet who would survive the end of the war. And perhaps best known for the work Everyone Sang. Talk a little bit about that particular poem and what it came to symbolize.
Well, I think it was written to symbolize, to represent Sassoon's feelings on the signing of the armistice. Sassoon had been the hero in the First World War. He had been one of the strongest of people who turned against the war. He wrote in 1917 a fierce declaration against it and refused to participate in it anymore. And an enormously important influence in his time and lived on, you know, well into our time. So when he writes about his feelings on hearing that the Germans had signed an armistice, I think that represents the feelings of almost everybody when the war ended. Everyone's voice was suddenly lifted, and beauty came like the setting sun. My heart was shaken with tears and horror drifted away. Oh, but everyone was a bird, and the song was wordless. The singing will never be done. I think that's such a wonderful way of expressing a feeling that the killing was over.
Let me end with this, which is that this book, as you mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation, includes many anecdotes from your family history. What did you learn in this process and the benefit of looking at it through a very personal lens?
Well, I think, first of all, it gives me a better sense of what my grandfather actually went through in 1914 and 1918 and what my father went through because he was in the infantry on the other side, of course. And it also made it clear to me, not that I'd ever had that much doubt about it before, how wrong it was for Woodrow Wilson to call the First World War a war to end wars. It did not end wars, of course. It led instead, 20 years later, to a Second World War. The First World War, indeed, until then, was always called the Great War because nobody anticipated there would ever be another. And I think it pointed out that whatever wars do, they do not bring war to an end. And also, examining that war, I think you begin to realize, as I take you through each battle, exemplified by the life of the poet who was in that battle and what he experienced, I think you also realize very, very strongly how war spreads rapidly and gets out of control. The First World War is a perfect example of that, in that the assassination of the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne moved from a small Balkan event to a war that involved nearly every major power and cost 25 million people their lives. So we must never underestimate the power of war to metastasize.
Michael Korda is the author of the new book, Muse of Fire, World War I, as seen through the wives of the soldier poets, published by Norton. Michael, what a great pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you for putting me on again, Joe, and my best wishes for complete recovery and good health and many more shows.
Thank you very much, Michael. Be well. Thanks so much.
You too.
Again, the name of the book is Muse of Fire by Michael Korda. It's published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.